so much of the experience of the mitzvahs that we do throughout the course of the year revolve around very specific and very particular measurements. It's what we call shiurim shel Torah. If anyone doesn't have a sheet, there are plenty in the back. Anyone not have one? So, what I'd like to talk about this morning is the development of the shiurim and whether or not they have changed throughout the many millennia. So, by way of introduction, we have a Gemara Maseches Sukkah, Daf Hei Amud Beis, and the same Gemara also appears in Erevin Daf Dalet Amud Aleph, where the Gemara tells us the following: Shiurin, Chatzitzin, Umachitzin. The Gemara tells us when it comes to the various shiurim, the various measurements that we find in the Torah, as well as Chatzitza, the laws of Chatzitza when one goes to the mikvah, men or women, and Machitzin, all the different laws, the intricate details of Machitzas, of Erevin, and of all of those issues that we find with regard to Shabbos, are all halacha lemoshe misinai. So if you just take the Gemara at face value, it would seem to be that halacha lemoshe misinai, we know, has the status of a din d'oraisa. Halacha lemoshe misinai is considered to be a mitzvah min haTorah. So if you take it at face value, I would have argued that all the shiurin shel Torah, all of the Torah measurements are considered to be mid'oraisa. The Torah mandates us to do mitzvahs in a very particular way, and that is what is expected of us to do. The Gemara comes to the conclusion that although that would seem to be the case, the Gemara says in the end that Hilchasaninu v'asmachinu rabbanan akra. The Gemara comes to the conclusion that although we consider these to be halacha lemoshe misinai, there is some form of relevance that the Torah gives to these shiurim, and the Torah does sometimes tell us what a shiur might be, but in general we understand that these are halacha lemoshe misinai. Now, this is all fine until we get to a Gemara Maseches Yuma, Daf Pei Amud Beis. So the Gemara tells us the following. Amar Rabbi Elazar writes the Gemara, Ha'ochel Chelev Bizman Hazeh. We have a lot of what we call Isuri Achila. One is not allowed to eat particular foods. One of those foods one is not allowed to consume is Chelev. You're not allowed to eat non-kosher fats or parts of an animal or non-kosher meat. So the Gemara says, in the times of a Beis HaMikdash, if somebody would go and eat Chelev, very simple. If you eat it b'mezid, you're going to be punished. If you eat it b'shogeg, you bring a chatas to the Beis HaMikdash. There's an easy way to do tshuva. What happens if a person b'zman hazeh, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, violates this prohibition of achilas chelev? Somebody goes ahead and eats prohibited food. What are you supposed to do? We don't have a Beis HaMikdash to offer a karbon, so how am I supposed to do tshuva? How can I make good for the mistake that I've made? So the Gemara tells us that if somebody eats chelev b'zman hazeh, Tzarech sheyichtov lo shiur. You have to write down how much chelev you ate. Why do you have to write down how much chelev you ate? So, if I ate a whole steak, then there's nothing to discuss. There's no question. It doesn't matter the exact shiur of what you ate. There's no doubt that what you ate was obviously enough to make you violate the Aveira. So, if you ate a whole steak, then it's obvious. There's nothing to write down. We're talking about where you take one bite, and after that one bite, you realize maybe this wasn't kosher, maybe I wasn't allowed to consume it, maybe I was not allowed to eat it. So the Gemara says, in that case, tzarech sheyichtov lo shiur. You have to write down how much you actually ate. Why is that? Shema yavo bezdin acher, because maybe later on, when the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt, maybe later on when I have the opportunity to offer that karban chatas for the mistake that I made, says the Gemara, maybe yavo bezdin acher, maybe another bezdin will come, v'yarbe b'shiurim. And they will reevaluate what the exact and particular shiur is all about. So what does that mean? It means the following. Let's say, how much does a person have to eat of prohibited food in order to violate an aveira? A kezayis, generally that is the shiur. Obviously Yom Kippur is a little bit different, that's the anomaly, but the general case that we have is that if you eat a kezayis, you're going to be punished. That's the prohibited amount of food that you're allowed to consume, that you're not allowed to consume. So the assumption is, if you eat less than a kezayis, you don't have to bring a carbon. If you eat more than a kezayis, you have to eat a carbon. Now, how much is a kezayis? I'll tell you, it's very simple. An olive, right? It's not so hard. So it should be very simple to figure out how much a kezayis is, but yet the Gemara tells us, when you have somebody, bizman hazeh, when there is no Beis HaMikdash, who's going to have to keep track of the fact that they did something wrong, so that when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, they can bring a carbon to do tshuva for this, says the Gemara, you have to make sure to write down exactly how much you ate. Why? Because maybe a future generation, when the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, is going to reevaluate the size of a kezayis. And maybe they're going to say the kazayis is not exactly what you thought it was. Maybe a kazayis is bigger or smaller. And based on their interpretation of what the size of an olive is, it will turn out that you're really not obligated to offer a carbon. So therefore, the Gemara tells us that we have to make sure that we write down exactly how much we ate in order to determine whether or not we're going to be obligated to bring a carbon later on when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. Now, that Gemara would seem to be an indication that all the shiurim are only midrabanan. If all the shiurim that the Torah mandates us to keep to abide by, are all midaraisa, then how can you say maybe a later Beis Din is going to reevaluate the shiur? How can they reevaluate a shiur? If the Torah set down the law and the Torah told us exactly how it's supposed to be done, so you're very learned, so you know the answer, but we're going to get there. So the question is, the Gemara says at face value, the Gemara says halacha l'Moshe miSinai, which would seem to indicate that everything was set, everything was fixed by Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Then the Gemara seems to have an indication that each Beis Din in every generation has a right to decide and to determine for themselves what they believe is the proper shear for various isurim, for various averis, for various mitzvahs. So how do we deal with this? What exactly is the understanding of that? So the answer is very simple. We have a concept that's along the lines of what you said, but we refer to it as nimsar hadavar lechachamim. And that's a term that's used by the Rishonim. The Ran and other Rishonim use that, which means the following. The Gemara talks about melacha on chalamoid. One is not allowed to do certain activities on chalamoid. And the question is Malachan Chalamoid prohibited midaraisa, or is Malachan Chalamoid only prohibited midrabanan? Did the Torah really tell us anywhere that you're not allowed to work on Chalamoid, or is that something that just came along later on in history? So that's a major question. The Gemara in Chagiga Daf Yud Gimel discusses the issue. And the Rishonim come to the conclusion, based on that Gemara, that even if you assume that Malachan Chalamoid is asur midaraisa, even if you assume the Torah expects us not to be working on Chalamoid, not to be doing certain activities on Chalamoid, the bottom line is, the Torah never said, don't use your computer on Chalamoid. The Torah never said, don't do certain activities. The Torah never outlines exactly what it is that you're not allowed to do. The Torah gives us the general prohibition. And Nimsar Hadavar LaChachamim means they filled in the details and they instructed us how to abide by that general overarching principle that the Torah set out for us. So the Torah said, in general, you're not allowed to work on Chalamoid. The Chachamim filled in the details and told us that that means X application, Y application, Z application. You can't do this, you could do that. But it's what we refer to as Nimsar Adavar LaChacham. That doesn't take away from the fact that it's Midaraisa. That doesn't take away from the fact that you're prohibited on a Torah level to do what you are doing. All it means is that the Chachamim were the ones who indicated exactly what the Torah meant to teach us, what the Torah meant to instruct us of. And that's the same with regard to the Shiurim. You look through all the pages of Chumash and nowhere will you find the Torah say, if you eat a kazayis, that's when you're going to be punished. And if you eat on Yom Kippur this amount or you drink that amount, nowhere does the Torah say that specifically. The Torah just gives us the general principle, and that is you're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, you're not allowed to eat on certain days of the year, you have to make sure to eat this amount of matzah, and you have to make sure that you don't eat that amount of non-kosher food. The Torah never said exactly, precisely what that measurement is. The Chachamim filled in the details and they told us what the Torah meant when it instructed us of that is the kazayas, the kibetza, the kakoseves, all the different shiurim, all the different measurements that we have. So we generally assume that this is certainly a biblical idea, it's a biblical concept, and that's why, for example, one of the very important ideas that we find is if you have a suffix, if you have a person who's in doubt about a specific shiur, about a specific measurement, we generally assume very often that one would have to be machmir, one would have to err on the side of caution, because after all, we're dealing with a safek d'oraisa, we're dealing with something which is on a Torah level, which is a biblical prohibition, a biblical command, and therefore we have to be machmir in order to make sure that we fulfill our obligation. So when Chazal set up the various shiurim, you will notice the various measurements that we find throughout the Torah are generally measured by plants, by fruits, by hands, by legs, by toes, by all different kinds, parts of the body or parts of nature that we are all familiar with. So, for example, you have the shear of kibetza. Kibetza means an egg. Kakoseves means a date. Kazayas means an olive. Or you have, the Torah tells us every so often, you have a measurement that's an etzba, a finger, or you have a tefach, which is, you know, a different part of the body. So we have very often the Shiurim Shel Torah were set up based on the measurements of either food items or plants or vegetables or parts of the body. And the question is, that seems so arbitrary. Why would we have set up a system where we measure by parts of the body or we measure by fruits or vegetables or parts of nature? Why is that the determining characteristic of how a shear is going to be measured? So the answer to that is twofold. The Rishonim write very simply. Number one, the Rishonim explained because they did not have a precise mechanism of measuring anything back in the times of Chazal. They didn't have what we have today. Right? Nowadays we have the ability to measure everything with precision. But they didn't have that back then. And to tell you the truth, it is very difficult today. The halacha didn't really speak in very specific measurements in general. So we're used to thinking about statistics and thinking about numerical values in the way that we see the metric system. So for us, we always want precise answers to our questions. You know, people ask, what is considered a shas adchak? You know, sometimes you have a shayla, and the answer is, b'shas adchak you're allowed to be mekel. Well, you define for me what's a shas adchak. That's a very fluid definition. It's not so easy to define very clearly exactly what is a shas adchak and what is not. And the answer is that the Torah did not always give us a system that was so precise. The Torah did not always set everything up with definitive measurements. And therefore, very often today, when we're used to a very definite system and we know everything should be with a metric system that we're familiar with, it doesn't always make sense to us because it's not so easy for us to measure in this way, which is a more fluid measurement. So, number one, the Rishonim say the reason why the Torah did this is because we did not have a precise way of measuring anything back then. So the greatest way to do that was with an olive that was available, and the egg, and the fingers, and the hands, and the toes, and the different parts of the body and nature that we knew were available all over the world. And secondly, the reason why the Torah did it this way is because we wanted to have a system that was going to be eternal and everlasting. And the only way to do that is to measure with something that is eternal and everlasting. So there will always be eggs, and there will always be olives, there will always be dates, there will always be hands, and there will always be feet. So that's the greatest way that you can have a measurement transmitted from generation to generation. Even if they lose the idea of exactly how many centimeters and how many ounces and how much of the measurement is supposed to be, there will always be hands and toes and feet and fruits and vegetables, and therefore the Torah assumed that is the most precise way for us to figure out how to measure the various measurements that we need throughout the year. So if you look, there is a Shari Tshuva, which is number Gimel, which is a Tshuva written by Rav Hai Gon. The Shari Tshuva is on Shulchan Aruch more famous because that is on every page of Shulchan Aruch we have a Shari Tshuva. But here, the Shari Tshuva is the responsa written by the Gaonim. The Gaonim lived in the times right before the Rishonim, right after the Chasimah Satalmud, right after the Gemara was completed. So the Gaonim write the following. The Gaonim tell us, why is it that all of the measurements that we find throughout our year, throughout our mitzvah observances, throughout all the averas that a person can violate, why is it that we find that they are measured by beitzim or fruits and vegetables and all these kinds of things? Lefisha habeitzim v'haperos nimtzaim b'chol makom. Because this is a universal way of measuring things, because we always have fruits and we always have vegetables and we always have the ability to find an egg. And therefore, ki gali v'yadua lefnei misha amar v'haya ha'olam. Because God knew from the outset, that the Jewish people were going to be dispersed all over the world, all over the globe. Umishkalon, umidasan, shahayu bimei Moshe, and the measurements that were set forth in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, v'shehosifu aleihem be'eretz Yisrael, ein nishmarim lahem. If Moshe Rabbeinu would have given them a measurement in ounces or in any other kind of metric system, it would have been lost because the Jewish people were dispersed all over the world. And there are so many traditions. Why do we have so much machlokas, not internal fighting, but why do we have so much halachic disagreement? Why is there so much discourse about what the halacha should be on every issue? And the answer is because nisgalgalu hadoros, the Jewish people ended up all over the world, and things became very unclear because we lost a lot of our tradition, a lot of the Mesorah. And because of that, Moshe Rabbeinu himself was concerned, and that's why he set down a system of measuring, which was something that could be eternal. Even if we would be going through many different phases of gullus, we would be able to stick to it anyway.
It doesn't make sense. There are small eggs, there are big eggs.
What? We're just getting started, so we're just getting started. Okay. V'amidos mishtanos bedoros. You're correct. You're correct, but the shiur just started, so just hold on to that comment. Uvimedino shebechol dar v'dar, And therefore he says, they wanted to set up a system that was going to be clear and universal, and therefore they said, this is the way it's going to work. We're going to set it up in a way that wherever you are in the world, you can always identify what the shiur is meant to be. Now, we do find that although the Chachamim wanted to set up a system that was going to be clear and that was going to be universal, we do find, as you very correctly mentioned, that that leads to a tremendous amount of uncertainty because different people's hands are different sizes and different eggs are different sizes and different olives are different sizes, and how are we supposed to know what those measurements are? And therefore we're left still with a discrepancy about how to figure out exactly how we're supposed to perform mitzvos or when we particularly violate an aveira. And this is a major problem not only with regard to the shiurim that we're familiar with, let's say the beitza and the egg and the olive and everything else, but it's with regard to other things as well. Let's say on Shabbos we have a prohibition to be mevashel b'Shabbos. You're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. So what does it mean you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos? What is considered to be cooking? How hot does the food have to get in order to be considered cooked? So we know the Gemara tells us in Masechah Shabbos that the general principle on Shabbos is if you want to violate the prohibition of cooking, you have to cook it up to a degree which is yad soledes bo. What is yad soledes? So it means your hand would get burned. So different people have different degrees of tolerance, right? Different people have different degrees of tolerance. I know there are some people who wash the dishes and they can have boiling hot water on and doesn't seem to bother them. Other people who, when they put their hand under a very hot faucet, they pull back right away. So what is that temperature? What is that degree? It sounds like a very universal measurement, but very, very correctly stated, it's not clear at all. For some people, that measurement might be a very high temperature. For others, it might be very low. And this is a major issue because today, if somebody cooks on Shabbos, how do you determine whether or not they've violated the prohibition of cooking on Shabbos? On the one hand, some say that that's 109 degrees. Some say it's 113 degrees. Some say it's much higher. Some say it's much lower. It's not easy to determine at all exactly what these shiurim are. And that led the Noda Yehuda, who was the Av Beis Din in Prague, in the 1700s, it led him to have the following observation. He said, look, I decided that I'm going to do a test. I'm going to do an experiment on my own to figure out, is the etzba, is the finger that Chazal used to measure various things throughout the Shiurei Torah, is that considered to be something that we have the proper measurement for, or perhaps have the Shiurim changed? Maybe human beings have become larger, maybe we are not as small as we used to be, and maybe therefore because of some sort of evolution, I don't know exactly what he means, but he says, human beings are either healthier or larger or growing more than they ever used to, and therefore he says, maybe everything should change and we have to reevaluate everything that we once took for granted. So the Noda Yehuda writes, he did an experiment, he did something on his own to figure out whether or not this was correct, and he came to the conclusion that everything that we always assumed was absolutely wrong, and the shiurim are almost twice the size of what they once were assumed to be. Okay? So, now what do you do? So now,
does that mean that they're subjective? In other words, they change, they're transitory based on
the. So that's the problem. What? Right. So that's the problem. The problem is, on the one hand, we set it up in a way that we wanted it to be universal. So we said we're going to have hands and feet and fingers and everything that's universal. But at the same time, you're saying it's subjective because depending on the generation, it's going to depend how high or how big or how small that shear might be. So this is a major issue that the Noda Yehuda in the 1700s was faced with. He came to the conclusion that it must be that we have to reevaluate everything. And he reevaluated, he reassessed on his own, and he came to the conclusion that everything is supposed to be twice the size of what it once was. So sometimes you go to some people's Seder, and you wonder, how much matzah are you supposed to eat on the night of the Seder? How much matzah are you supposed to eat? What? Four kazesim? Why four kazesim? What? So that's a question. How do you get to a half of a whole piece, right? Very often, you come to a Seder. How much are we obligated to eat on the night of the Seder? One kazayis. You have to eat a kazayis of matzah on the night of the Seder in order to fulfill your obligation. How do we come to a measurement of a half a piece of matzah when we're talking about one kazayis? How did that happen? It's impossible that that's the size of an olive. It's certainly much bigger than the volume of an olive. So where do we get these exaggerated measurements from? How does that make sense? So that's the question. Do we say they became bigger or they became smaller? Did the olives become bigger and the hands became bigger? Or the olives became smaller and the hands became bigger? So we have to reevaluate everything, right? So Noda Yehuda We have to take all of this into consideration, and everything needs to be calculated once again from scratch. We have to start everything over. And he says, indeed, he did this calculation, and it turns out that everything is really twice the size than it once was, and that's why we find the very exaggerated shiurim of what an olive is. Everybody would agree that if you would just take an olive, it would not be the size of a half a matzah, right? Everybody would agree to that. But the question is, maybe the size of an olive in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu were much bigger, and maybe we're supposed to follow the size that he set down, or maybe we can reevaluate and reassess and say that the olives of our times are what we're supposed to use. So this is the question that was raised by the Noda Yehuda. Take, for example, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Trefos, there are many different things that would invalidate an animal to be consumed. So we have many, many different trefos. If it has a hole in the lung, or it has certain issues, internal issues in the organs that are Evarim Shana Shama Tluya Bahem, very important and vital organs of the animal, we assume that that animal is no longer able to be consumed, even if you shecht it and you do everything properly. But if you determine that inside there were major problems, you would not be allowed to eat it. So the question is, the Rambam writes, that the only way that you know that an animal is a trefa, if it's something that's ena chaya yud beis chodesh, if it cannot live, if it cannot survive 12 months with this ailment, with this illness, then we know that for certain it is a trefa. So the question is, we know today that there are many issues that are internal issues inside of the animal, that the animal can continue to live far longer than 12 months, even with all of these internal issues. So how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that? On the one hand, this is what the Gemara tells us is a trefa. This is what the Gemara says is going to invalidate the animal. But the Gemara also tells us if it has this issue, it's not going to live for 12 months. Do an experiment. Go take a CAT scan of an animal, see if it has this issue, and see if it lasts for 12 months. So the stipler deals with the issue. The stipler lived in Bnei Brak, and he dealt with the issue, and he said, look, as far as trefas are concerned, whatever Moshe Rabbeinu told us, whatever the Gemara set down as being considered a trefa, is what it is, because that was based on the science of their time, that was based on the understandings of their time, and therefore that sticks, even though we know today that medically it's just simply not true. Even though we know today that even though this animal might have that problem, it can still continue to live far longer than 12 months, we would still say that that animal is considered to be a trefa regardless. So this is a very major issue in general, because we have so many different areas of halacha that are determined based on shiurim or based on certain understandings in the times of Chazal, and that has changed so many times, and the question is, how do we deal with all of those changes? So, as we mentioned, the Noda Yehuda wrote that everything had to be reevaluated, and in his opinion, everything was twice the size. Here we come to a very fascinating issue. And it's an issue because, generally, when you have a disagreement, generally, when you have a machlokas, it's based on a svara, it's based on something that you feel this is correct, you feel that position is correct, I feel this is a good source, you feel that's a good source, so we can argue about it. Here we have a disagreement about something that's very practical, about a shear, about a measurement, and everyone's fighting about just how big is a hand. So how much is there to fight about? It's a very strange question. Just go figure it out. Yeah.
But maybe it's a more fundamental question, that the reason, that the fact that these were given, hands, foot, etc., mm-hmm. means that it's supposed to be an approximate amount, and that therefore the idea of having a specific shear is maybe not real.
So that's true. That is true. That is true. No, you're all correct that it should be an approximation because they never gave us definitive numbers. But at the same time, what if the approximation is twice the size? So the Noda Yehuda said, you're right that it's an approximate. There's a certain margin of error that you can have for an approximation. But if I'm measuring and now it's twice the size of what we always assumed it to be, something has to change. It can't be. So the Noda Yehuda's great Talmud, Rebbe Lezer Fleklish, writes in the Tshuva Me'ava. This is number Hey. He has a tshuva sefer where he records the experiment that was done in the times of his Rebbe, the Noda Yehuda. So he writes the following. Abel chalila v'chalila. He says, I was there when my Rebbe did the experiment, and it's true that he came to the conclusion that it's twice the size of what we always imagined it to be, but he says, chalila v'chalila, don't ever make the mistake and think, lahakel ba'avur chesbon hazeh b'shir achila b'yom ha-kippurim. He says, look, my Rebbe did an experiment and he came to the conclusion that everything is twice the size. So on the one hand, twice the size means you have to eat twice the amount of matzah that you always thought you had to eat. But it also means that on Yom Kippur, you're allowed to eat twice the amount that you always thought you were allowed to eat. So he says, no. The Noda Yehuda never meant to say that you're allowed to eat twice as much on Yom Kippur, more than you ever imagined you were allowed to eat. That's never what he had in mind. All he had in mind was in the other direction, that when you have a positive commandment to eat matzah, or to eat any mitzvah that the Torah tells you you have to eat, it means you have to eat twice as much as you originally thought, but not to be used in the other direction, lahakil. Why not? What? So that's the question. Why should we make that distinction? Why should there be a differentiation at all? If you believe that the shear has changed and you believe that now it's twice the size as it once was, then it should be across the board. That should mean on Pesach you have to eat twice as much matzah, and it should mean that on Yom Kippur you can have twice as much food as well and still not be punished. Okay. So let's see what he says. So let's see what he writes. He says, Kimori v'rabi hagon no debi Yehuda. My Rebbe, the Noda Behuda, when he originally made this experiment, lo balahakel al shatora ela lahachmir. All he had in mind was to say that when it comes to a mitzvah, we have to eat twice as much. But he never came to say in the other direction that we should be lenient when it comes to Yom Kippur. Ula anias daiti. And now he gives his own opinion. He says, look, I watched this experiment, I saw what happened, and I saw the conclusive results that he came up with. However, he says, la anias daiti, according to my humble opinion, Mori v'Rabbi Hagon, my Rebbe, the Noda Behuda, was very mistaken in his research. Why? He says, because he was Chishev l'fiha agudo shalo. He did the experiment based on himself. V'hu ha'yarech bedoro. And he was a giant. So, if you do an experiment and you are not the normal size of regular average people, so obviously you're going to come to the conclusion that it's twice the amount. And then he writes, it's a nice line that he says, Mishichva v'mala gavoa mi'alko gavoim. He says, my Rebbe was a great person in many ways. Number one, he was a great mind. He was a great Talmud Chacham, a great Tzaddik, a great Posek, but he was also great in his size. And therefore he says, his hand was twice the size of everybody else's, and you cannot come to a conclusion that wasn't a controlled experiment. That was not conclusive. So one second. He says his hand was twice the size of everybody else's. As anybody who ever met him knows, he says, now he was in the 1700s, so we didn't have the chance to meet him, but he says everybody knew that he was much bigger, twice the size of everybody else, and therefore his experiment was not conclusive at all. And therefore he writes, listen to this last line, Kudvarim Ela Amarti the Mori v'Rabbi. He said, when this experiment was going on, I turned to my Rabbi and I said to him, look, this is not a fair experiment. And he says, he voiced his concern to him, and his Rabbi responded, V'hayim enanea berosho, and he was shaking his head as I was talking, V'sachak, and he laughed. So now is a fascinating piece of history. There's a machlokas about how to interpret the laugh of the Noda Behuda. You know, I learned in my father's shiur for 8 years. I had a great opportunity to learn in the shiur and to learn with him b'chavrusa. And one of the greatest parts of it was watching the guys disagree about how to interpret the different phrases that my father uses when he responds to different students who come to talk to him. So sometimes my father will say, I don't know. So there's a machlokas about what does I don't know mean? Well, it depends how he says it. Does I don't know mean that you're making me crazy, so just go away? Or does I don't know mean I just really don't know the answer? So it depends. You have to know the Rebbe very well to understand which I don't know he means. So here, that's what I was reminded of. Whenever the guys used to fight about what exactly he means when he says this or that, so this is what I was reminded of. Here there's a major disagreement. There's a dispute in the Acharonim exactly. How do you interpret the laugh of the Noda Behuda? Was the Noda Behuda telling his Talmud, you're so annoying, get away from me? Do you think I didn't consider that? You think I didn't take that into the equation, that I'm twice as big as everybody else? Of course I did, and I still came to the conclusion that I came to. Or does the laugh mean, you have a good point, and I was wrong? So this is a major issue, which has very important consequences. So you look on the next page, number Vav, and you'll find that the Ma'ari Asad, who was one of the great Rabbanim in Hungary in the 1700s, came right after the Noda Behuda. He passes away in 1866, so he has a discussion about how to interpret the laugh of the Noda Behuda. What exactly does it mean? So he writes the following. He says, Rabbi Lezer Fleklish, who was the Talmud of the Noda Behuda, raised opposition against this Rebbe about the experiment that was done. And he argued with him and he said, I think you're proofs that you came up with are inconclusive because, after all, you're much bigger than everyone else. Adasher nana larosha v'shachak, until the Rebbe shook his head and he laughed at him. Ukanira shehodalo. And it seems that he agreed to him. It seems that he was in agreement. Okay, so if he's in agreement, that means out the window, back to where we started, which means keep the shiurim to what they were, let's keep everything, you only have to eat a kezayis and matzah the way we always knew a kezayis and matzah, Yom Kippur is going to be the same Yom Kippur, and everything's going to be the same, nothing's going to change at all. Because after all, the Noda Behuda shook his head and he laughed, which means, shake your head and you laugh, means you agree. So that was the end of the story. However, the Chazon Ish, more recently, Chazon Ish was closer to our generation, and the Chazon Ish argues that this is ludicrous to say such a thing. How can you argue that the Noda Behuda, who was one of the greatest halachic authorities of all generations, who's going to tell me that the Noda Behuda didn't consider this possibility that he was bigger than everyone else? You think he was that foolish? You think he was that oblivious? So writes the Chazon Ish as follows, number Zion. And the Chazon Ish was known to be an extremely respectful person. And the way he writes is usually a very mild style of writing. He has a very beautiful style in the way he interprets so many areas of halacha. But here he goes out on the limb, and he's totally unforgiving of all those who believed that the Noda Behuda was mistaken. So he writes the following. Mashakasa b'tshuva me'ava. This that the Sefer Tshuva Me'ava writes, that his Rebbe was mistaken, ki agon ha'Noda Behuda eino benoni, he says that his Rebbe was not an average-sized person, v'chein amar kein lefana v'shacha kagon zal, and he said that he mentioned his argument to his Rebbe, and the Rebbe laughed at him, and he shook his head, eino ela petume mili. He says this is nonsense. It's total nonsense. V'ein roi lahavim lebeis medrash. They don't even belong in a halachic discussion. It's such nonsense, it doesn't even belong in the conversation. Why? Ki ha'Noda Behuda lo yada shetzarach ha'benoni. Was the Noda Behuda that foolish? Was he that oblivious? He didn't realize that in order to do a proper experiment, you have to really be an average-sized person? Val karchach. And it must be da'afo gav da'haya balkoma. It must be that even though the Noda Behuda was a very tall and above-average person, agudel shelo haya benoni. It's clear that obviously his hands were normal size. He writes, the Tshuva Me'ava doesn't write that he was there at the time when they did the experiment. He just says that he heard about it. And then he went subsequently to argue with his Rebbe about the findings of the experiment. If he was there at the time when all this was going on, he would have spoken up then. He wouldn't have gone to him later. He saw it in the Sefer of the Noda Behuda. So how does he know? When the Noda Behuda did his experiment, maybe he called one of the students and he said, let's measure with you because I would not be a fair measurement. Do you think the Noda Behuda didn't consider this, he asks? And if really the Tshuva Me'ava, Rabbi Elazar Fleklish, was correct in this question that he raised to his Rebbe, even though it's inconceivable that the Noda Behuda didn't think of it, and you really believe that the Noda Behuda therefore retracted from his opinion and said everything I said was wrong, is this not an issue of extreme importance? Don't you think this is an important issue? To know how much matzah you have to eat on Pesach? To know how much you're allowed to eat on Yom Kippur? To know everything else about all the shiurim that the Torah mandates us to keep to and to abide by? Is this not something that the Noda Behuda should have written about? To write a retraction? If he really believed that his student was correct? So you write a public opinion, you write something that you feel is the halacha, you're trying to change the status quo for thousands of years, your student comes along and tells you, no, your argument is incorrect. Do you think the Noda Behuda would not have retracted from his tshuva that he wrote originally? Of course he would have. Something of this great importance, something that is this consequential, that is this essential to everything that we do in mitzvahs throughout the year, do you think the Noda Behuda would not have retracted if he thought his Talmud was correct? And therefore he says it must be that when the Noda Behuda laughed at his Talmud, he was saying, you don't know what you're talking about. And the laugh, the way the Chazon Ish interprets the laugh was, he was trying to say, you're being annoying. You don't know what you're talking about. I didn't experiment very carefully. I knew what I was doing. And let's close the issue. And the experiment that I did was proper. And I still came to the conclusion that I came to. So this is a big question in general in halacha, when we find there are many who argue that there were gedolim over the many generations who retracted from their opinions. One very common example that's very relevant today. What? Yeah, everyone says different things about Rav Moshe, okay. But here's let's say, a very practical example that comes up all the time. So there's a major shaila about using baby wipes on Shabbos. What's the question about using baby wipes on Shabbos? Maybe it's chita, you're squeezing, you're not squeezing. So everybody weighed in on the issue. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes officially in the Shmir Shabbos Kachasa, which is the definitive rulings of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on Hilchos Shabbos. He writes clearly there that he feels there's no issue of schita on Shabbos at all, and baby wipes are allowed to be used. Okay, that's what he writes. There's a very great Talmud Chacham by the name of Rabbi Rubin, who lives in Har Nof, who wrote also a very important sefer on Hilchos Shabbos called the Archos Shabbos. It's a three-volume set. It's a great set of svarim. He writes in there that he heard, in the name of the students of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that Shlomo Zalman Auerbach retracted his opinion and did not allow baby wipes to be used on Shabbos. Now, if that's really correct, that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach really retracted, then he should have retracted. And if it's something that's as common as baby wipes, that every family that has children has to be aware of, and every family that has children has to think about, that's half the Jewish families in the world have young children, or a quarter of the Jewish families in the world have young children. At some point, everyone's going to have children. Anyone who's raising children is going to have this issue. So the question is, if you really believe that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach retracted from that, wouldn't he not have been responsible enough to write that? After all, he wrote his psak, Lahakel. Would he not have written somewhere else and found the opportunity how to publicize his opinion? He would have. So that's why there are many who argue, we don't accept the testimony of his students who say that he later retracted his opinion. He should have written that. He was a responsible person. He was a leader of the generation. He should have let us know in a more conclusive way that he was rescinding his opinion and that he was reconsidering. And this is something that in general the Chazon Ish writes as a Davar Pashut. The Chazon Ish assumes this is obvious. If you have a person who takes responsibility, if you have a person who is a posek of generations, if you have somebody who is giving a psak that is changing the status quo, and then they turn around and change their opinion back to what it was, they have the responsibility, they have the obligation as a leader to actually retract from their opinion and to let us know that they retracted and to be responsible enough to print it in the same place where they printed the first opinion. And if we don't find that, then it probably means that they have not retracted. Even though there are many who say otherwise, we can stick, writes the Chazon Ish, with the original opinion that we found, which is his conclusive argument by the Noda B'Yehuda as well. You want to come along and change everything from the status quo of what it was. And you print that you think it should be changed. Someone comes along and argues that, no, it shouldn't be changed because you retracted and you don't believe in the Chiddush that you printed. So do we give that credibility? Does that have any credence in the religion that we follow? Probably not. Writes the Chazon Ish, it probably does not. And I think it's an issue to be thinking about in our generation because we hear things all the time about somebody retracted, somebody wrote this, and then changed their mind. So really, does changing the mind really change the opinion? Or does the responsible leader have to change their mind in public and write a public disclaimer that they have changed their mind in order for everyone to be well aware of the issue? So this was an issue, as we mentioned, in the 1700s, early 1800s, with the Noda B'Yehuda and all those who came after him. It resurfaced once again in the 1900s with the discrepancy between Reb Chaim Noe and the Chazon Ish, who once again were trying to figure out and determine, let's try to do our own experiments and figure out, are the shiurim the same, or should they be re-evaluated once again? And this was an issue that Reb Chaim Noe and the Chazon Ish tried to figure out, should we be following the opinion of the Noda B'Yehuda today, or should we say we're going to stick with the old measurements? The conclusion that the Mishnah Berurah comes to in Hilchos Pesach, when he talks about eating matzah and many other things, is that when we're performing a mitzvah, we should try our best to be machmer for the Noda B'Yehuda. And that is why in many communities you find that when one comes down to eat matzah on the night of the Seder, we find a very exaggerated shear. We find that even though a kazayis today is certainly not the size of a half a matzah, the volume is much greater. The half a matzah is much greater than the volume of an olive. We still find that most people try their best to eat a larger size. And the reason for that is very simple, because we assume that the Noda B'Yehuda may have been correct in his experiment that he did, in his evaluation, in his determination, and therefore we assume that he has to be taken into consideration, and when it comes to a mitzvah, we try our best to cover our bases. Safek d'oraisa l'chumra, we try to cover our bases, and therefore writes the Mishnah Berurah, when it comes to a mitzvah mid'oraisa, we try our best to follow his opinion, even though it was highly questionable whether or not he stuck to his own opinion or not. So that is a important issue to be aware of. There is one final point before we end. I see we're out of time already. And that is a point to consider with regard to the concept that the halacha has of rubo kakulo. Rubo kakulo means we have every so often where the Torah tells us that we have to have a certain shear, we have to have a certain measurement. So for example, by shechita, when you shecht an animal, it says you have to cut, you have to sever both the kana and the veshet, both of the pipes of the animal have to be severed. However, the Gemara says in Maseches Chulin, we have a principle, a concept called rubo kukula, which means if you shecht, if you slaughter most, if you sever most of those pipes, that would suffice, that would be good enough. And this is a concept that we find in many areas. Let's say by a woman who gives birth, when do we assume that the child is considered to be born? Do we have to wait for the entire body to be out? Or do we assume once rubo, once most of the body is out, that we assume the baby is considered to be born? And we have many areas in halacha where we apply the principle of rubo kukulo. The Gaonim have a question. Why don't we say, let's say, mixas hayom kukulo. Why don't we say that we have a concept also in halacha, let's say, by shiva, where you have most of the seventh day. We know that the avil doesn't sit shiva the entire seventh day. We assume once you sit part of the seventh day, that is enough. So the Gaonim ask a question, why don't you say the same thing by Shabbos? Once you keep most of Shabbos, and now it's Shabbos morning, we should be allowed to go to work, we should be allowed to drive a car. The same way by Shiva, once the morning comes, it's over. So why don't you say the same should apply by many other areas of Halacha, Shabbos, Yantif, or anything else like that. Tisha B'Av, we should say, once you get through the morning, so it should be good enough, Tisha B'Av should be over, Mixas Hayom Kukula. So where you determine, what? How you determine where the principle applies and where it doesn't is a good question. The Rishonim apply it in certain instances in Halacha, and in others, obviously, we do not. And this is an issue about where do we draw the line. Why don't we say Rubo Kukulo should govern in the other direction as well, meaning we have Shiurim that the Torah says, and we say that once you do most of it, it's good enough. So how far do we take that? If you eat most of a Kezias, is that good enough? No, you have to eat a Kezias. So why don't you say Rubo Kukulo? Torah says it has to be a certain Shiur, but if you have less than the Shiur, it seems you have not fulfilled your obligation. Why is that so? Why do we not follow the principle of Rubo Kukulo that we follow in many other instances in Halacha? Why shouldn't that be the governing factor here as well? And that's a question that one has to think about in many areas. Let's say when it comes to a mikveh, we need to have a minimum size mikveh in order for the mikveh to be able to work, to be metaira. So the official size is mem sa. You need to have 40 sa of water. So why don't you say Rubo Kukulo if you have 25 sa? That should be good enough. As long as I fit into the water in the mikveh, that should be sufficient. And the answer is we don't say that. So that's an issue that many great achronim try to figure out. How do we determine when the principle is applied of Rubo Kukulo and we say most of it is good enough? And when do we say that no, the Torah set out a very particular and specific shear, and without that shear, without meeting that requirement, you actually have nothing. If you don't eat the amount that you're supposed to eat for matzah on Pesach, you have nothing. If you don't go into a mikveh that has 40 sa, you have nothing at all. So they refer to this as a shir nekuda and a shir mitzdarif. What that means is the following. There are times, it doesn't really answer the question, it just gives us categories how we refer to various shirim in the Torah. And they say that there are certain shirim in the Torah that are referred to as a shir nekuda, which means if you don't meet that criterion, if you don't meet that size, that measurement, you have nothing. So, if you don't have the kezias that you need to eat on the night of the Seder, I don't care that you ate most of it, but if you don't have that, the shir nekuda means you haven't hit that point. You haven't done the requirement that is expected of you. If you don't have the 40 sa in the mikveh, you can't say that you have most of it. It's a shir nekuda. It's something that the Torah said, if you don't have that specific amount, you have nothing at all. There are other times where the Torah says, all you need is a shir mitzdarif. A little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more adds up to this amount. If you do most of that amount, that would be sufficient. But it's, again, as we said, this doesn't answer the question, it just makes two categories. Now you have to figure out why each one belongs in each category is a good question. Let's say the Prima Gada Mass in Hilchas Shabbos, we know that we have an Isser of Tchumen. You're not allowed to go outside of the Tchuman Shabbos. Simple. You're not allowed to go too far. So he writes, so why am I even allowed to take one step on Shabbos? Why don't you say it's a Chatzi Shir? Why don't you say you're doing some of the prohibition already because you already took one step? The answer is because, what do you mean? If I only take one step, I haven't done anything yet. The only time the question begins is when you take one step further than you're supposed to. So when do you say most is considered like all, and when do you say if you haven't done it all, you haven't done anything at all? So this is a very important question when we think in general about Shiurei Torah, when we think about the measurements of the Torah, number one, do we have the right to assume that they developed over time? Do we have the right to assume that they change from one generation to the next? Do we have the right to assume that we can reevaluate in each generation and figure out whether or not the kibetzah is the same size, and whether or not we assume that the olive is the same size, and whether or not the hands and the feet and the toes and the fruits and the vegetables, are they all the same as we once assumed them to be, the volume of those items? Or should we assume that, no, whatever Chazal said at the time is what it is, and even though we find today that our measurements that we are familiar with, and our eggs that we're familiar with, are not at all the same as what they were in the times of Chazal, maybe they should still be governed by the rules that Chazal set down for us. The same way the Rambam writes in Hilchos Trefos, that when it comes to determining what makes an animal invalid to eat, to be consumed, even though we know today medically that it is not at all similar to what it was in the times of Chazal, and we know that an animal can live far longer than what we assumed an animal was able to live in the days of Chazal, but the Rambam writes anyway in Hilchos Trefos that whatever Chazal determined is what it is. So, do we assume that for all measurements, or do we assume that only in Hilchos Trefos? Once we get past that issue, you have to determine when we have a shear in the Torah that is considered to be a shear nekuda. When do we assume that, unless you fulfill that requirement, unless you have exactly that amount, you have not done your mitzvah at all, you have done nothing? Or are there times in Chazal when we assume that the shear was meant to be a shear mitzdarif, which means a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more add up to the shear that you're supposed to have? But as long as you've done most of it, we can assume Rubo Kukulo, as long as you've done most, we assume that that's already sufficient and you wouldn't have to finish it off. So this is a very important question, it's a very big issue, and it's been debated back and forth throughout the generations, and it has many, many ancillary nafkaminas. It has many different places in which it plays out, because, after all, every mitzvah that we perform is really based on a very particular shear, because otherwise you don't really know how to perform the mitzvah, you don't know how much the Torah expected you to do, or how little the Torah expected you to do. And this is something that should be considered for every mitzvah that we need to perform throughout the year. So we're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we're going to continue with the next shiur, which will be also in here. After that, we're going to go downstairs for those who are registered for lunch. Lunch is going to be downstairs, and we'll have mincha after lunch. And Rav Amar will be joining us after that, also downstairs in the first floor. Yeah? Yeah, correct.